tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to part 16 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am your host, Ted Midward. Today's segment is going to focus on Jewish control of the American theater. Let's jump right into it. The theater has long been a part of the Jewish program for guidance of public taste and the influencing of the public mind. Not only is the theater given a special place in the program of the protocols, but it is the instant ally, night by night and week by week, of any idea which the power behind the scenes, quote-unquote, wishes to put forth. It is not by accident that in Russia, where they now have scarcely anything else, they still have the theater, specially revived, stimulated, and supported by Jewish Bolshevists, because they believe in the theater just as they believe in the press. It is one of the two great means of molding popular opinion. Everybody has assumed offhand that the theater is Jew-controlled. Few, if put to the test, could prove it, but all believe it. The reason they believe it is not so much what they see as what they feel. The American feel has gone out of the theater. A dark, oriental atmosphere has come instead. Not only the legitimate stage, so-called, but the motion picture industry, the fifth greatest of all the great industries, is also Jew-controlled, not only in spots, not 50% merely, but entirely, with the natural consequence that now the world is in arms against the trivializing and demoralizing influences of that form of entertainment as at present managed. As soon as the Jew gained control of American liquor, we had a liquor problem with drastic consequences. As soon as the Jew gained control of the movies, we had a movie problem, the consequences of which are not yet visible. It is the genius of that race to create problems of a moral character in whatever business they achieve a majority. Every night, hundreds of thousands of people give from 2 to 3 hours to the theater. Every day, literal millions of people give up from 30 minutes to 2 hours to the movies. And this simply means that millions of Americans every day place themselves voluntarily within range of Jewish ideas of life, love, and labor, within range of Jewish propaganda, sometimes cleverly, sometimes clumsily concealed. This gives the Jewish masseur of the public mind all the opportunity he desires, and his only protest now is that exposure may make his game a trifle difficult. The theater is Jewish, not only on its managerial side, but also on its literary and professional side. More and more plays are appearing whose author, producer, star, and cast are entirely Jewish. They are not great plays. They do not remain long. This is natural enough, since the Jewish theatrical interests are not seeking artistic triumphs. They are not seeking the glory of the American stage, nor are they striving to develop great actors to take the place of the old line of worthies. Not at all. Their interest is financial and racial, getting the Gentiles money in Judaizing the theater. There is a tremendous Judaizing movement on. The work is almost complete. Boastful articles are beginning to appear in the Jewish press, which is always a sign. Gentile attendants on the theater are frequently insulted to their faces and never know it. Recently, one of the best now Jewish entertainers on the stage indulged in vulgar and sacrilegious references to Jesus Christ, whereat the Semitic portions of his audience went into loud laughter while the Gentiles sat blank-faced, because the remarks were in Yiddish asides. Time after time, the Jewish entertainer did that thing, and it was plain to one who knew that the Jewish portion of the audience was enjoying the insult to the Gentiles much more than they were enjoying the well-worn humor of the entertainer's remarks. It was a great thing for them in that several important American cities they could see and hear being done undercover, and to American Gentiles, what is being done openly to Russian Gentiles. In the audience referred to there was probably $4,500 to $5,000 in gate money represented. Of this, the Jews present, at the very highest estimate, could not have contributed more than $500. Yet the Jewish star several times slapped the religious sensibilities of the major portion of his audience under the cover of Yiddish. The theater is felt by him and his ilk to be a Jewish institution. Down to 1885, the American theater was still in the hands of the Gentiles. From 1885 dates the first invasion of Jewish influence. It meant the parting of the ways, and the future historian of the American state will describe that year with the word Ichabod. That year marks not only the beginning of the Jewish wedge of control, but something far more important. It is not important that managers are now Jews, whereas managers were formerly Gentiles. That's not important. The importance begins with the fact that with the change of managers, there came also a decline in the art and morals of the stage, and that this decline has become accelerated as the Jewish control became widened. What Jewish control means is this: that everything has been deliberately and systematically squeezed out of the American theater except its most undesirable elements, and these undesirable elements have been exalted to the highest place of all. The great age of the American theater is past. About the time that Jewish control appeared, Sheridan, Southern, McCullough, Madame Janáček, Mary Anderson, Frank Mayo, John T. Raymond, began to pass off the stage. It was natural that, life being brief, they should pass at last, but the appalling fact began to be apparent that they had left no successors. Why? Because a Hebrew hand was on the stage, and the natural genius of the stage was no longer welcomed. A new form of worship was to be established. "Shakespeare spells ruin," was the utterance of a Jewish manager. "Highbrow stuff" is also a Jewish expression. These two sayings, one appealing to the managerial end, the other to the public end of the theater, have formed the epitaph of the classic era. All that remained after the Hebrew hand fell across the stage were a few artists who had received their training under the Gentile school: Julia Marlowe, Tyrone Power, Artie McLean, and, a little later, Richard Mansfield, Robert Mantell, E.H. Southern. Two of this group remain, and with Maude Adams they constitute the last flashings of an era that has gone, an era that apparently leaves no great exemplars to perpetuate it. The present-day average of intelligence appealed to in the American theater does not rise above 13 to 18 years. The tired businessman, quote-unquote, stuff, another Jewish expression, has treated the theater-going public as if it were composed of morons. The appeal is frankly to a juvenile type of mind which can be easily molded to the ideals of the Hebraic theatrical monopoly. Clean, wholesome plays, the few that remain, are supported mainly by the rapidly vanishing race of theater-goers who survived from an earlier day. The present generation has been educated by the narrowed compass of modern dramatic themes to support plays of an entirely different type. Tragedy is taboo. The play of character, with a deeper significance than would delight the mind of a child, is out of favor. The comic opera has degenerated into a flash of color and movement, a combination of salacious farce and jazz music, usually supplied by a Jewish songwriter. The great purveyors of jazz, of course, are Jewish, and the rage is for extravaganza and burlesque. The bedroom farce has been exalted into the first place. With the exception of Ben-Hur, which is favored by Jewish producers apparently because it holds before the public a romantic picture of a Jew, a very un-Jewish Jew, by the way, the historical drama has given way to fleshy spectacles set off with overpowering scenic effects, the principal component of which is an army of girls, which are mostly Gentiles, whose investment of drapery does not exceed 5 ounces in weight. Frivolity, sensuality, indecency, appalling illiteracy, and endless platitude are the marks of the American stage as it approaches its degeneracy under Jewish control. That, of course, is the real meaning of all the little theater movements that have begun in so many cities and towns in the United States. The art of drama, having been driven out of the theater by the Jews, is finding a home in thousands of study circles throughout the United States. The people cannot see the real plays, therefore they read them. The plays that are acted could not be read at all, for the most part, any more than the words of jazz songs can be read. They don't mean anything. The people who want to see the real plays and cannot, because Jewish producers won't produce them, are forming little dramatic clubs of their own, in barns and churches, in schools and neighborhood halls. The drama fled from its exploiters and has found a home with its friends. The changes which the Jews have made in the theater, and which any half-observant theater-goer can verify with his own eyes, are 4 in number. First, they have elaborated the mechanical side, making human talent and genius less necessary. They have made the stage realistic instead of interpretive. The great actors needed very little machinery. The men and women on the payrolls of the Jewish managers are helpless without the machinery. The outstanding fact about the vast majority of present-day performances of any pretension is that the mechanical part dwarfs and obscures the acting, however good. And this is the reason. Knowing that good actors are growing scarce, knowing that the Jewish policy is death to talent, knowing perhaps most keenly of all that good actors constitute a running charge on his revenue, the Jewish producer prefers to put his faith and his money in wood, canvas, paint, cloth, and tinsel, of which scenery and costumes are made. Wood and paint never show contempt for his sordid ideals and his betrayal of his trust. And thus, we have, when we go to the theater today, bursts of color, ruffles of lace and linen, waving lines and dazzling effects of light and motion, but no ideas, a great many stage employees, but very few actors. There are drills and dances without end, but no drama. That is one influence on the American theater that the Jews claim, and the credit for which can be given him in full. He has put in the iridescence, but he has taken out the profounder ideas. He has placed the American public in the position of being able to remember the names of plays without being able to recall what composed them. Like the Floridora Girls, a Jewish creation, we remember the name of the group, but not of any individual in it. The Jew has done this to perfection, but no one will contend that it represents a forward step. Taken by and large, it is part of a very serious and harmful retrogression. Second, the Jews may be credited with having introduced Oriental sensuality to the American stage. Not even the most ardent Jewish defender will deny this, for the thing is there before the eyes of all who will see. Little by little, the mark of the filthy tide has risen against the walls of the American theater, until now it is all but engulfed. It is a truism that there is more unrefined indecency in the higher class theaters today than was ever permitted by the police in the burlesque houses. The lower classes must be restrained in the vicarious exercise of their lower natures, apparently, but the wealthier classes may go the limit. The price of the ticket and the class of the playhouse seems to make all the difference in the world between prohibited and permissible evil. In New York, where Jewish managers are thicker than they ever will be in Jerusalem, the limit of theatrical adventuresomeness into the realm of the forbidden is being pushed further and further. Last season's spectacle of Aphrodite seemed to be deliberately designed as a frontal attack on the last entrenched scruple of moral conservatism. The scenes are most oriental in their voluptuous abandonment. Men in breech clouts, leopard skins and buckskins, women in flimsy gowns of gossamer texture, slashed to the hips, with very little besides, made a bewildering pageant whose capstone was the unveiling of a perfectly nude girl whose body had been painted to resemble marble. Save that it was all designed and all put through on schedule, it was almost the limit to which such exhibitions could go in real life. Its promoter, of course, was a Jew. As an entertainment, it was infantile. The splendor of its insinuations, the daring of its situations, were the fruitage of long study of the art of seducing the popular mind. It was said when Aphrodite first appeared that the police had moved against it, but some held that this was a clever press agent stunt to excite public interest in the promised extravagance. It was also said that even had the police interference been the genuine result of outraged official minds, the fact that the Jews of New York are represented in the judiciary out of all proportions to their numbers would have rendered the Jewish producer free from interference. In any event, the peace was not molested. The sale of narcotics is illegal, but the instilling of insidious moral poison is not. The whole loose atmosphere of cabaret and midnight frolic entertainment is of Jewish origin and importation. Mention the best and the worst known, they are all Jewish. The runway down which less than half-dressed girls cavort, fluttering their loose finery in the faces of the spectators, is an importation from Vienna, but a Jewish creation. The abuses of the runway will not bear description here. The Paris boulevards and Montmartre have nothing at all in the nature of lascivious entertainment that New York cannot duplicate. But neither New York or any other American city has that Comédie Française that strives to counterbalance the evil of Paris. Where have the writers for the stage a single chance in this welter of sensuousness? Where have the actors of tragic or comic talent a chance in such productions? It is the age of the chorus girl, a creature whose mental caliber has nothing to do with the matter, and whose stage life cannot, in the very nature of things, be a career. It is only occasionally that a great writer for the stage, a Shaw, a Masefield, a Barry, an Ibsen, or any Gentile writer of merit, is permitted to get as far as actual production, and then only for a short period. The stream of colored electric lighting effects, of women in tinsel clothes in behind them, and they are washed away, to survive in printed books among those who still know what the theater ought to be. A third consequence of Jewish domination of the American stage has been the appearance of the New York Star system, with its advertising appliances. The last few years of the theater have been marked by numerous stars that never really rose, and certainly never shone, but which were hoisted high on the advertising walls of the Jewish theatrical syndicates in order to give the public the impression that these feeble lantern lights were in the highest heaven of dramatic achievement. The trick is a department store trick. It is sheer advertising strategy. The stars of yesterday, who did not even survive yesterday, were either the personal favorites of the managers or goods taken off the shelf and heaped into the window for the sake of giving the appearance of a new stock. In brief, whereas in normal times the public made the star by their acclaim, nowadays the Jewish managers determine by their advertisements who the star shall be. The New York stamp, which frequently means nothing at all, is the one imperial sign of favor. According to the Jewish theatrical hierarchy, it is just this New York stamp that the rest of the country protests against, and the little theater movement throughout the West and Central West is a significant protest. A Mary Anderson or a Julia Marlowe would be impossible under the Jewish system. They were disciples of art, who later became artists, and then were rightfully acclaimed as stars. But their development was a tedious process. Their fame was based on the rising approval of the people, year after year. These actresses put in season after season, traveling the same circuit, learning little by little, rounding out their work. They did not have, nor did they seek, the New York stamp. They worked first for the approval of the people, of the provinces, which is the contemptuous Jewish term for the rest of the United States. There was, however, no Jewish dictatorship of the theater when Mary Anderson and Julia Marlowe were building their art and careers, which throws a light on the reason for there being no Mary Andersons or Julia Marlowes coming up to the succession. The Jew seeks immediate success in all but racial affairs. In this breakdown of the Gentile theater, the process cannot be too swift for him. The training of artists takes time. It is far simpler to have the advertising bills serve as a substitute, and, as the itinerant faker dentist had a brass band blare loud enough to drown the anguished cries of his victims, so the Jewish manager seeks to divert attention from the dramatic poverty of the theater by throwing confetti, limbs, lingerie, and spangles dazzlingly into the eyes of his audience. These three results of Jewish control in the theater are all explainable by a fourth. The secret of the serious change which has occurred since 1885 is found in the Jewish tendency to commercialize everything it touches. The focus of attention has been shifted from the stage to the box office. The banal policy of give the public what they want is the policy of the panderer, and it entered the American theater with the first Jewish invasion. About 1885, two alert Jews established in New York a so-called booking agency and offered to take over the somewhat cumbersome system by which managers of theaters in St. Louis, Detroit, or Omaha arranged engagements of attractions for their houses for the ensuing season. The old process involved extensive correspondence with producing managers in the East, and many local managers were obliged to spend several months in New York to make up a season's bookings. The advantages were that the booking agency, supplied with a list of the open dates of the houses they represented, were able to lay out a complete season's itinerary, or route, for a traveling company, and enabled the producer of a play to spend his vacation at the seashore instead of passing the sultry mid-season in New York, while the local manager was saved the trouble of much writing or even a trip east, and was content to let the booking concern attend to all details and send him his next season's bookings when completed. In this manner was laid the foundation of the later-day theatrical trust. The booking firm was that of Claw and Erlanger, the former a young Jew from Kentucky who had studied law, but drifted into theatrical life as an agent. The latter, a young Jew from Cleveland with little education, but with experience as an advance agent. The booking system was not of their devising. They borrowed the idea from Harry C. Taylor, who established a sort of theatrical exchange where producers and local managers could meet, desks being provided them at a small rental, and who took over the booking in the smaller cities without foreseeing, but probably scorning, the opportunity thus placed in his hands to the club, the whole theatrical world into submission to his dictates. With characteristic shrewdness, Claw and Erlanger elaborated the idea they had borrowed from Taylor, opened competition against the latter, and enlisted the support of a number of young Jewish advance agents who were beginning to recognize the lucrative opportunities which the theatrical profession had afforded. Prominent among their earlier supporters was Charles Frohman, employed by J.H. Haverly. His brother, Daniel, had been business manager for the Mallorys at the Madison Square Theater since 1881, and though the Frohmans stand out in relief from the background of the Polish-Jewish influence on the theater, they found it to their advantage to cooperate with the booking firm and subsequently became prominent members of the Trust. The establishment of the Jewish booking agency system is the key to the whole problem of the decline of the American stage. The old booking system had the enormous advantage of the personal touch in the relationship between manager and company, and made possible the development of genius in accordance with the organic laws, which determine nurture, growth, and fruition. Except in its highest form, acting is not an art, but heaven-born genius is no more vocal in an Edwin Booth without long training than a Bonaparte is necessarily a world conqueror without the technique of the artillery school. These two thoughts have the utmost bearing on giving the Jews the control of the theater. There being no syndicate, no pooling, among the Gentile managers of the 80s, they presented their stars or other attractions at rival theaters in competition as individual offerings, and at the end of a reasonable New York run, not forced for road consumption, took their companies on a tour of the country. The manager's whole investment was probably tied up in his enterprise. He thus became a part of his group of artists, sharing their hardships of travel, their joys, and their sorrows. If business was good, they shared the satisfaction. If otherwise, it was sink or swim for one as well as the other. In those days, much was heard about troops traveling on their trunks, quote-unquote. The stories were not exaggerated, but life had its better side, too. The manager and the actor were daily companions. There was a mutual absorption of the ideas. The manager learned to know and appraise the artistic temperament, which is a tangible asset when not a form of artificial grouch or congenital ill nature, and to respect the actor's point of view, while reciprocally, the actor was able to place himself in the manager's position and to get his point of view from close personal affiliation. That's the end of this article. It was published January 1st, 1921. And as you can see, it's probably no surprise to you these days, when the Jews took over the theater, they watered it down and appealed to man's lowest nature, sensuality, his animal urges, and pretty much left it totally devoid of anything artistic of a higher art, so to speak. And I'm sure you'll agree that they've done this with the motion picture industry for the last 100 years, or probably 100 plus years now. I think Birth of a Nation came out in 1915, so, and that was like the first Gentile production, and probably really the last of its kind. And from there, the Jews created and took over Hollywood and took over the art of motion picture, and have steadily watered down the art form and created something today where it's all about sex appeal, skin appeal, scantily clad women, offensive humor, the basest of humor, and just a cheap money-making scheme. They put no true sense of art or thought into it. It's more about a money-making racket, and just like Henry describes here, they use advertising to produce stars. They don't let the stars develop and let the people decide the stars. Instead, they use advertising to trick you into thinking that everyone is a star. Okay, moving on to the second half of part 16. This is entitled The Rise of the First Jewish Theatrical Trust. It has long been known among dramatic critics that the reason for the maintenance of Ben-Hur in the theater for 19 years is this. It is the most successful of all the vehicles for pro-Semitism now on the stage. That will appear to be a prejudicial statement in the minds of the thousands who have seen and enjoyed Ben-Hur, but there is truth in it. The point which should not be overlooked, however, is that if Ben-Hur is useful in framing the public mind favorable toward the Jews, it is not because of a pro-Semitic intention in the story. That may be the intention of the producers, like Claw and Erlanger, but it was not the intention of General Lew Wallace. It would seem that art and fate conspire against the propagandist play, for in no other way can the failure of avowedly pro-Semitic drama be explained. Perhaps there was never such a serious and even strenuous attempt made to force the Jewish-controlled theater into the service of pro-Semitism as has been made in recent months, and the attempts, with one possible exception, have been failures. Lavishly produced, heralded by an unbroken clack of press announcement, swathed in an initial chorus of praise, sponsored by officialdom which had been dragged out to stand a godfather to the productions, they nevertheless have failed. Be it said to the credit of the American Jew that he has been one of the causes of the failure. A most significant and hopeful sign was the reaction of the intelligent Jewish community against the attempt to utilize the stage as a hustings to boost the Jew into an unreal eminence in desirability. Certain competent Jews wrote their opinions about this with much freedom and wisdom, and they evinced a spirit which, if it could be made to permeate all Jewish activities, would quickly dispose of the Jewish question under whatever phase it may be considered. It is this spirit of judging Jewish interests in the light of the whole which promises a helpful and lasting solution of all the differences which, unfortunately, have been permitted to arise between the people of Judah and the others. The fact of Jewish control of the theater is not of itself a ground for complaint. If certain Jews, working separately or in groups, have succeeded in wrenching this rich business from its former Gentile control, that is purely a matter of commercial interest. It is precisely on the same footing as if one group of Gentiles won the control from another group of Gentiles. It may be regarded as a business matter. In this, as in other business matters, however, there is the ethical test of how the control was gained and how it is used. Society is usually willing to receive the fact of control with equanimity, providing the control is not used for antisocial purposes. The fact that old-time Gentile-producing managers usually died poor, Augustin Daly being about the only exception, while Jewish producing managers, wax immensely wealthy, there being on this side the exception of late Charles Frohman, this would indicate that the Gentile managers were better artists and poorer businessmen than the Jewish managers, at least poorer businessmen, perhaps, and in any case working on a system whose chief object was to produce plays and not profits. The advent of Jewish control put the theater on a more commercialized basis than it had previously known. It really represented applying the trust idea to the theater before it had been largely applied to industry. As early as the year 1896, the Theatrical Trust controlled 37 theaters in strategic cities. The men composing this alliance were Claw and Erlanger, Nixon and Zimmerman, and Heyman and Frohman. All but Zimmerman were Jews, and his racial origin was a subject of dispute. This group was later joined by Rich and Harris of Boston and Joseph Brooks, all known as Jews. Controlling these theaters, the trust was able to assure a long season to both managers and playing companies. Outside the trust, the managers and companies were left to make arrangements between each other, which resembled a species of barnstorming. The effect on the independent theaters and managers was disastrous. The trust boosted royalties on plays from $50 to $450 and eventually to $1,000 a week. This, of itself, cut off the material of the stock companies with which the independent managers endeavored to keep open their houses. The running out of the stock companies by excessive charges for the use of plays that had already been used in the regular theaters of the trust really served Jewish interests in another way. The motion picture industry was coming to the front. It was a Jewish enterprise from the first. There never was any need to drive Gentiles out of that because the Gentiles never had a chance to get in. Thus, the driving out of the stock companies threw the empty theaters over to the movies, quote-unquote, and the benefit was again confined to a particular racial group. This will answer the question so frequently asked by people who wonder why the theaters they formerly saw offering plays at all seasons are not devoting the larger part of the year to movies. It was not to be expected that this sort of thing could be put through without a struggle. There was a struggle, and a severe one, but it is ended with what the public can see today. The opposition offered by the artists was prolonged and dignified. Francis Wilson, Nat C. Goodwin, James A. Hearn, James O'Neill, Richard Mansfield, Mrs. Fisk, and James K. Hatchett stood out for a time, all of them, with the exception of Goodwin, bound by a forfeit of $1,000 if they deserted the cause of a free theater. Joseph Jefferson was always with the actors in this opposition and continued of the same mind to the end, playing in both trust and antitrust houses. It is a matter of record that Nat Goodwin was the first to give in. He was the head and front of the opposition, but he had his weaknesses which were well known to the trust and upon which they played. One of his weaknesses was for New York engagements, and he was offered a long engagement at the Knickerbocker Theater. He was also given the promise of dates wherever and whenever he wanted them. Goodwin thereupon deserted the alliance of stars and became the henchman of the trust. Here's an author's note. The trust was the name by which the new control was known in these days. The racial name was not given, although the racial nature was plainly discerned. Nat Goodwin's star began to decline from that day. He made a final essay as Shylock, and with that he was practically ushered out as a headliner of the serious stage. Richard Mansfield and Francis Wilson were delivering nightly curtain speeches against the trust wherever they appeared, and although the public was sympathetic, it was very much like the present state of affairs. What could the public do? What can an unorganized public ever do against a small, organized, determined minority? The public hardly ever appears as a party in any of the movements that concern itself. The public is the prize for which the parties strive. The trust dealt strongly with Wilson. His dates were canceled. Neither his status nor his ability was of any avail to him. One of the trust made an open statement. Quote, Mr. Wilson is a shining mark, and we determined to make an example of him for the benefit of the lesser offenders. End quote. Wilson's strong spirit was finally subdued to see a reason. In 1898, the Philadelphia members of the trust offered him $50,000 for his business, and he took it. In due time, Richard Mansfield also surrendered, and Mrs. Fisk was left alone to carry on the fight. The theatrical trust, which must be described as Jewish, because it was that, was at the beginning of the new century in full control of the field. It had reduced what was essentially an art to a time clock, a cash register system, working with the mechanical precision of a well-managed factory. It suppressed individuality and initiative, killed off competition, drove out the independent manager and star, excluded all but foreign playwrights of established reputation, fostered the popularity of inferior talent, which was predominantly Jewish, sought to debase the service of the dramatic critics of the public press, foisted countless stars of mushroom growth upon a helpless public while driving real stars into obscurity. It handled plays, theaters, and actors like factory products, and not began a process of vulgarizing and commercializing everything connected with the theater. If space permitted, a number of opinions could be presented here from men like William Dean Howells, Norman Hapgood, and Thomas Bailey Aldrich, whose concern was for the theater, but who voiced no other observation as to the racial influences at work. Their concern was justified. It is quite possible that many who read this article are not interested in the theater and are, in fact, convinced that the theater is a menace. Very well. What principally makes it a menace, though? It's this, that the stage today represents the principal cultural element of 50% of the people. What the average young person absorbs as to good form, proper deportment, refinement as contrasted with coarseness, correctness of speech or choice of words, customs and feelings of other nations, even fashions of clothes, as well as ideas of religion and law, are derived from what he sees and hears at the theater. The mass's sole idea of the homes and the life of the rich is derived from the stage and the movies. More wrong notions are given, more prejudices created by the Jewish-controlled theater in 1 week than can be charged against a serious study of the Jewish question in a century. People sometimes wonder where the ideas of the younger generation come from. This is the answer. As we just said, all the original opposers of this new control of the theater surrendered and left Mrs. Fisk to fight alone. She had, however, an ally in her husband, Harrison Gray Fisk, who was editor of the New York Dramatic Mirror publication. Mrs. Fisk herself had said, "The incompetent men who have seized upon the affairs of the stage in this country have all but killed art, ambition, and decency." Her husband wrote in his paper, "What then should be expected of a band of adventurers of infamous origin, of no breeding and utterly without artistic taste? Let it be kept in mind that the ruling number of these men who compose the theatrical trust are absolutely unfit to serve in any but the most subordinate places in the economy of the stage, and that they ought not to be tolerated even in these places, except under a discipline, active, vigorous, and uncompromising. Their records are disreputable and in some cases criminal, and their methods are in keeping with their records. That's an excerpt from the Dramatic Mirror, published on December 25, 1897, reprinted on March 19, 1898. This attack was regarded, foolishly and wrongfully, of course, as an attack on the whole House of Israel, and, as is always the case when one Jew is censured for wrongdoing, all the Jews in the United States came to the rescue. Well, the Jews aren't Israel, are they? Henry probably didn't know that back then, nor did his researchers. We know that today, though. Continuing on, pressure was brought to bear on a famous news company which handled the circulation of the most important magazines in the United States. Leading hotels were induced to withdraw the Dramatic Mirror from their news stands. Mirror correspondents were refused admittance to the theaters controlled by the trust. Any number of underground influences were set in operation to get Fisk and his business. Suit was brought against Fisk for $10,000 worth of damages for the strictures he had printed upon the personal character of certain members of the trust. Fisk replied in his answer, setting up various facts against specific members of the trust, their records, actions, and so on. One he accused of carrying on business under a fictitious name, or a cover name, as it's known in Jewish circles. Another he accused of charging managers for advertising expenses that were never incurred. Another he accused of issuing complimentary tickets, in which he did a private speculative business of his own, selling them and pocketing the proceeds. Another he accused of specific crime for which he had been arrested and convicted. He charged that the trust as a whole advertised in various cities that, quote, the original New York company, unquote, would play, charging exorbitant admission fees on the strength of this advertisement, when in truth, these were secondary companies and not the one advertised. A strange court hearing was held in which the magistrate did not wish to hear any of Fisk's testimony, even forbidding him to enter official records of the criminal proceedings had against a certain member of the trust. The magistrate did not seem to want to hear what Fisk based his statements upon. There was a serious shooting scrape involving a woman, but the magistrate did not want to hear about it. There was even considerable difficulty on the part of Fisk's lawyer in procuring the attendance of Abraham L. Erlanger at court, although he was one of the complainants. All the important questions asked of Claw and Erlanger were overruled. As to Al Haman, the court overruled all questions relating to his real name and the circumstances under which he left Australia. The facts were not brought out in this hearing, but the whole character of the hearing was made known to the public. Fisk was bound over to the grand jury with $300 bail in every allegation of libel. The grand jury lost no time in dismissing all the complaints against Fisk. The trust members had come off badly because of their evident unwillingness to meet the case. They were revealed to be a much lower type of men than the American public had supposed was in charge of the American theater. They were shown to be a type that would not even stop at demanding the discharge of a local newspaper reporter whose critique of their plays did not please them. The fight of the dramatic critics, first against the bribery and then against the bludgeoning of the theatrical trust, makes a story of which echoes have frequently come to the American public through the press. Conciliatory at first, with managers, actors, playwrights, and critics, the trust, as soon as it gained power, showed the claws beneath the velvet. It had the millions of dollars of the public coming its way, so why should it care? Wherever a critic opposed its methods or pointed out the inferior, coarse, and degrading character of the trust productions, he was ordered barred from the trust's theaters and local managers were instructed to demand his discharge from his paper. It is with mingled feelings that an American is compelled to relate that in many, many cases, the demand was complied with, the papers being threatened with the loss of Sunday advertising. But here and there, courageous writers on the stage held to the honor of their profession and refused to be bribed or intimidated. Writers like James S. Metcalf of Life, Hillary Bell of the New York Press, Frederick F. Schrader of the Washington Post, Norman Hapgood on the New York Evening Globe, James O'Donnell Bennett of the Chicago Record Herald, all stood out against the trust and made their fight. Metcalf went so far as to bring suit against the trust for unlawful exclusion from a place of public amusement. The courts were kind to the trust. They decided that a theater may pick its patrons. Even in very recent years, the trust has followed blacklisted dramatic critics in an effort to prevent their employment by newspapers. The theatrical trust does not exist in the form it did 10 years ago. It grew arrogant and bred secret enemies among its own people. A new force arose, but it was also Jewish, as it originated in the Schubert brothers with David Belasco. Instead of one, the Americans now have a dual dictatorship of the stage. The rage of the day is not plays, but playhouses. With not three plays of any character to distinguish them from the dregs of the stage, they are now building in New York alone a dozen new playhouses. The theatrical business has entered upon its real estate phase. There is money in renting chairs at the rate of $1 to $3 an hour. The renting of the chairs is a reality. The stage is rapidly becoming an illusion. This was published by the Dearborn Independent on January 8, 1921. And there you have it. Henry Ford and his researchers laid out the reality of Jews taking over the theater business almost 100 years ago now. And today we have the same story with Hollywood and the motion picture film industry. It's always the same thing. When the Gentiles controlled it, it was artistic, it was decent, it was inspiring, it was heartfelt, it was dramatic, it was really an art form. The Jews came in and watered it down quite a bit. Used sex to sell tickets and to rent chairs, as Henry puts it, and have pretty much ruined any integrity that it had. And you need look no further than this isn't a cause of it, and this isn't directly related, but it's a symptom of the culture of Hollywood, this Harvey Weinstein story. And of course, we all know about Corey Feldman, the 80s child star actor who's made allegations of sexual misconduct and pedophilic abuse in Hollywood of the younger stars. And this is just what happens when wolves come in. They devour the sheep, and it's changed, and it's no longer 1950s America with the Lone Ranger in Bonanza and Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver on TV and in the movie theaters. It's totally different. I hope you guys have enjoyed. Until next time, this is Ted Midward of Caucasian Christian Communications signing off. Take care, be well, God bless, bye-bye.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.